This is Scenic Roots Talking Writing. This is the second half of my conversation with Margaret Renkel, an essayist. Living in Nashville, Margaret writes a weekly column for the New York Times, in which she tells people, the majority of whom don't live in the South, about the South. But then again, she'd be the first one to concede the impossibility of that task. As she notes in her introduction to this collection of 60 of her essays for the New York Times, titled Graceland at Last. The problem with trying to typecast an entire region is not just that red states aren't confined to the American South, or that the American South itself isn't reliably red, or that Southern voters are motivated by varied and complex priorities. It's that there is no one South in the South. The Deep South is as different from the Mid-South and the Upper South as the Mid-South and the Upper South are from each other. The urban South looks far more like its counterparts in the urban North and the urban West than it does the rural counties in its own states. The coastal South and the mountain South might as well be two separate countries. The immigrant South overlaps them all, multifarious in too many ways to list. But by writing keenly observed essays about everyone from John Prine to John Lewis and Jimmy Carter, and everything from rattlesnakes resting on the back porch to wildflowers along the highway, and in this essay from an earlier collection, A Family of Bluebirds, Margaret Renkel confounds the abiding stereotypes about the South by showing its abundant contradictions. This is an excerpt from Margaret Renkel's previous collection of essays titled Late Migration, read by Joyce Bean.
The first year, a day before the baby bluebirds were due to hatch, I checked the nest box just outside my office window and found a pinprick in one of the eggs. Believing it must be the pip that signals the beginnings of a hatch, I quietly closed the box and resolved not to check again right away, though the itch to peek was nearly unbearable. I'd been waiting years for a family of bluebirds to take up residence in that box, and finally an egg was about to shudder and pop open. 2 days later, I realized I hadn't seen either parent in some time, so I checked again and found all 5 eggs missing. The nest was undisturbed. The cycle of life might as well be called the cycle of death. Everything that lives will die, and everything that dies will be eaten. Bluebirds eat insects, snakes eat bluebirds, hawks eat snakes, owls eat hawks. That's how wildness works, and I know it. I was heartbroken anyway. I called the North American Bluebird Society for advice, just in case the pair returned for a second try. The guy who answered the helpline thought perhaps my bluebirds, not mine, of course, but the bluebirds I loved, had been attacked by both a house wren and a snake. House wrens are furiously territorial and will attempt to disrupt the nesting of any birds nearby. They fill unused nest holes with sticks to prevent competitors from settling there. They destroy unprotected nests and pierce all the eggs. They have been known to kill nestlings and even brooding females. Snakes simply swallow the eggs whole, slowly and gently, leaving behind an intact nest. The bluebird expert recommended that I install a wider snake baffle on the mounting pole and clear out some brush that might be harboring wrens. If the bluebirds returned, he said, I should install a wren guard over the hole as soon as the first egg appeared. The parents weren't likely to abandon an egg, and disguising the nest hole with a cover might keep wrens from noticing it. I bought a new baffle, but the bluebirds never came back. The next year, another pair took up residence. After the first egg appeared, I went to the local bird supply store and asked for help choosing a wren guard, but the store didn't stock them. House wrens don't nest in Middle Tennessee, the owner said. I know they aren't supposed to nest here, I said, but listen to what happened last year. He scoffed. Possibly a migrating wren had noticed the nest and made a desultory effort to destroy it. But there are no house wrens nesting in Middle Tennessee. All 4 bluebird eggs hatched that year, and all 4 bluebird babies safely fledged. So I figured he must know this region better than the people at the Bluebird Society, and I gave no more thought to wren guards. The year after that, there were no bluebirds. Very early in February, long before nesting season, a male spent a few minutes investigating the box, but he never returned with a female. Even the chickadees, who nest early and have always liked our bluebird box, settled for the box under the eaves near the back door. All spring, the bluebird box sat empty. Then I started to hear the unmistakable sound of a house wren calling for a mate. Desperately, the wren would call and call, and then spend some time filling the box with sticks, building an elaborate scaffolding that formed a deep tunnel running across the top of the box and down to its very floor. Day after day, singing, sticks. The side yard was his exclusive domain. No longer did the chickadees visit the mealworm feeder on that side of the house. The goldfinches abandoned the thistle feeder nearby. Only the largest birds dared drink from the birdbath. I set another dish of water on the other side of the house because we'd had so little rain. Meanwhile, the chickadees hatched out a magnificent brood of babies. Their voices were full and strong, and their parents worked continually from sunup till dark feeding them. After they fledged, right on schedule, I took the box down for cleaning. At the bottom was one fully feathered baby, probably only minutes from leaving the box. It was dead from a puncture wound to the head.
That's Joyce Bean reading an excerpt from one of Margaret Renkel's essays on life in the South. Writing these weekly essays for the New York Times, she said, is
the dream come true. I didn't have the nerve to dream it, so you can't even call it a dream come true.
I can see it from their point of view. You write passionately about such a range of topics. When you say something like, every form of prejudice matters, perhaps especially so when the people who keep pointing out the splinter in someone else's eye are trying to see around a plank in their own. Somebody who can write like that deserves a job at the New York Times.
That's very kind of you to say. It's mind-boggling how big the New York Times is. Not just in terms of its staff, but its reach. How many people subscribe and how many people interact with it on social media. It truly is. I sometimes, when I interview people, I sometimes have to warn them a little bit. You know, like, you're going to hear from people you haven't heard from in 40 years because they're going to see your name in this piece. It's just kind of staggering to think about.
It's the heft of it, you know, just saying, I'm from the New York Times, you know.
Well, I don't actually work for the New York Times, you know, I'm just a freelancer.
Well, that's true for all of us, you know. Nobody really works for the New York Times, because the New York Times, as we understand it, as with all media, is a creation. It doesn't exist other than in the minds of everybody that reads it, right? It's just a newspaper, but we imbue it with this.
Yeah, but some of the people who work for it get benefits, so yeah.
We've invested it with this kind of august edifice that it's still a bunch of people in front of computer screens writing, albeit they do it very well. I don't think at this point that what I do is any different than what people at the BBC do, but I don't have that same credibility because I don't work for the BBC. If I did, I don't think I'd do anything any differently. So in that sense, the work you do has value of its own. The outlet in which it appears imbues it with kind of credibility and a kind of credence that it might not have in another publication, but it's still the same essay. Do you know what I mean? Does that make any sense to you?
I do. I think people are always, sometimes when people ask me, how did you come to write for the New York Times? What they mean is, I've never heard of you. Where did you come from? And there's a disconnect in their mind how somebody could get to be my age. I'm going to be 60 in October. And just suddenly, out of thin air, appear in the pages of the New York Times. And the truth is that, you know, I had a career. It mattered to me. It mattered to some other people, I'm convinced. And you know, what I'm writing now wasn't appreciably different, I don't think, from what I wrote when I wrote a weekly column for the Nashville Scene. But, of course, the audience is much smaller, and, you know, people think if they haven't heard of it, they don't immediately think, oh, I must be limited in my frame of reference. They think, oh, it must not be important. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think to some degree that's a function of the medium. You know, people who read the New York Times regularly think if it's not in the New York Times, then it can't be important. And the producer for the program told this reporter, I'm going to give you a zip code. I want you to go there and find a story. She said, each week I'm going to give you a different zip code. I want you to go and find a story. That's his whole brief. And the show runs about 15 minutes. And one story, he thought he was pursuing one story. And while he was pursuing that story, this guy, rather like a blue bottle, kept buzzing around him, bugging him, saying, I want to talk to you, I want to talk to you. And he's like, yeah, whatever, whatever. And it turns out that the guy was a roadie for Jimi Hendrix. He knew the Beatles, and he'd been very much part of everything that was going on in London in the 60s, which, you know, once you're in, you're in, and it's a pretty small city, really. And then in the 70s, became a fairly successful pornographer here in the United States. So, you know, what are the odds of turning up a bloke like that, you know? But that's the BBC. That's their attitude. You know, it's in some ways, it's the obverse of that attitude of the New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, or NPR, every story that's important. Well, how do you know, who's to determine what makes a story important? I think the only thing that matters, and it definitely matters in my mind, and I think maybe it does at the New York Times too, is does the writer have any credibility? And you have credibility to burn. You know, it comes through on every page that you write, whether you're writing about a place where eagles nest in the wintertime, or Graceland, or the fact that there's 13,807 miles of wild flowers along Tennessee's highways. Who knew?
Isn't that remarkable?
It's a wonderful idea, you know.
It is, and I remember when that column ran, how many people were truly dumbfounded that this visionary approach to encouraging pollinators could be found in Tennessee, of all places.
Forgive me, Margaret, but that sentence says it all. In Tennessee, of all places. Let me tell you, I grew up just south of London. South London. You know, London's, I don't know how well you know it, but it's bifurcated by the river. So yes. It's effectively the south, or it's either south or north of the river, east or west of the centre of London, but north or south of the river. And I live south of the river. The idea was that nothing good would ever come from south of the river, you know. Oh,
right.
You're from there.
Right.
You know? When I moved here, people would say, where are you from? And initially, of course, I gave them exactly where I was from, which just, this is nothing but blank stares. They had no idea what I was talking about. So after a while, I twigged it and I said, oh, I'm from London. London? Oh, so impressed. You know, they thought that was just, you know, that's just it. You know, oh my God, you're from London? Oh, that's so cool, you know.
Isn't it funny how just the frame of reference changes everything?
Yeah, whether it be the newspaper, the National Public Radio, or where we're from, it's all just a construct, you know, it's all just. And so I think that's the beauty of what you do, is that you deconstruct that construct in people's minds. You constantly confound it by saying, oh, wait a minute, have you considered this?
Well, you put your finger right on what I hope to do. And I'm I think I'm not always successful in doing that, but that is definitely what I hope to do, is to, not necessarily to confound readers, but just to encourage people to understand that human beings are always more complex than stereotypes allow for.
Yes, exactly. That's what I meant. You confound people's expectations or assumptions. Not by, and I think it's the beauty of all good writing, not by telling, but by showing.
It's amazing to me how many people have an opinion about the South who have never been here and who don't have, or who have never been anywhere but, you know, a fast food restaurant off an interstate highway, but who feel perfectly confident making pronouncements about the region nonetheless. And it's amazing to me, because if all I knew of New York City was Brooklyn Nine-Nine, you know, I would not presume to say I understood Brooklyn. You know, it's just, but if you watch Andy Griffith, or you watch the Beverly Hillbillies, or you watch the Dukes of Hazzard, you form an imaginary South in your mind that is apparently very hard to shake.
I guess it comes back to the whole notion of a stereotype. It's so easy to grasp, and it's got such hard lines. You know, it's, in my mind, something that clearly defined is probably not true. Because, as you said, life is more complicated than that.
You know, Harper Lee left us a very, I think probably inadvertently, but left us a very clear illustration of this whole point. In letting To Kill a Mockingbird stand for all those years, decades, and then publishing Go Set a Watchman. So the vision we have as readers of small town Alabama during the years of the Depression, and the hero that is Atticus Finch in that novel, is almost impossible to reconcile with the Atticus Finch who emerges from Go Set a Watchman, which takes place at a later time, as they're just beginning to be stirring in the fictional Macon of a civil rights movement. And so many people that I know, white people, not black people, but white people, can't make that work in their mind. How can Atticus Finch be this and also be this? And yet, that is not hard for me to understand at all, that a fictional character could be based on a human being who was both of those things. Of course, black readers read Go Set a Watchman and they go, well, of course he was a racist. He always was. You know, how could he have been anything else?
We're looking at Atticus through the eyes of a little girl.
Right. That's the key thing. Because the little girl is a grown woman in Go Set a Watchman. Of course, Go Set a Watchman is an incomplete work. It was not a finished novel. It was Harper Lee's first attempt to write about these characters. And so it doesn't have the polish of the finished To Kill a Mockingbird. But that difference in perspective is key to the two novels. But it's also true that a character like Atticus could be completely comfortable defending the innocence of someone falsely charged with a crime he didn't commit, and also be a person who wouldn't think that the black members of his community should be given the same rights as the white one. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things about Nashville that I think people who read what I write in the Times that sometimes don't quite get is that it's not that often that something happens in Nashville that is of any particular interest to a national audience. Covering Nashville is not my beat for the New York Times. But Nashville is, in some ways, a fairly emblematic place in that what is happening in Nashville, and especially in Nashville's relationship with the state of Tennessee, is so similar to what happens to other cities in other largely rural states. It's the same thing, you know, that is true of Charlotte and the Triangle area of North Carolina. It's true of Atlanta and Athens relative to Georgia. It's true of Birmingham relative to Alabama and New Orleans relative to Louisiana and Austin relative to Texas. This is just what happens here is so often of a piece with what is happening in nearly every other red state. And I hesitate to use that term because, again, I don't want to assume that politics drives everything, but it drives a lot. And the adversarial relationship between Nashville and Tennessee is, at least between the world view, that is more apparent in Nashville than in rural Tennessee. I don't mean compared to Chattanooga or compared to Memphis or even to Knoxville, but certainly to Tullahoma is, or Hohenwald or Paris. It's very, very much like what's happening in other places. So in that sense, I really can only write about Nashville if what's happening in Nashville is part of some kind of larger thing that's going on in the country. So I want people to see about the South how much more there is here than politics and political division. How it's the Tennessee Department of Transportation that is seeking to preserve the pollinators, unexpected though that might be. There are ways that things can be complicated in a wonderful way and not an upsetting one.
Well, thank you, Margaret. Well,
thank
it's
you
always
for
nice
this.
To
thank
speak
her.
To a kindred spirit.
And it's just lovely to speak to somebody who took so much time with the book. You read it, and I'm grateful.
I love your writing. I like the all-embracing approach that you take to it. You know, that they have asked you to do the impossible, and you're doing your best to do just that, to encompass the South in your essays.
I'm trying. Well, I'm trying to decide whether I should object to that characterization. I don't know that they expect me to do anything. They expect me to find them a good subject to write about, for to read about every week.
What was your brief? What did they say to you when they first asked you?
Well, what they said at the time and what they want now are two different things.
It kind of evolved, didn't it?
Well, the leadership at the section evolved or changed anyway. There's a whole new bunch of people in charge than the people who were in charge when they offered me this gig. But they basically said, if you find it interesting, we're going to find it interesting. But they laid out that flora, fauna, politics, and culture as my sort of my parameters. Make sure I hit those areas from time to time, pretty regularly, all of those areas. So that's why that's how I've taken it. But I do think there's a little more urgency now to on the culture and politics side. I sense nobody said you have to do this. Nobody has ever told me you have to write about this or anything of that sort. I send in a description of what I'd like to write about, and then my editor says yes or no. I can't. A couple of times he said, I'm not sure that's really the kind of thing that would appeal to a national audience, but mostly, almost always, he says yes, and then I write it, and then we, if he has concerns, I fix those, and we go from there.
Well, it puts you in the wonderful position of being able to write something that's both macro and micro.
I have to be careful, honestly. I have to, for my own mental health, I have to write. I'm not a politics reporter, and I don't want to be one. I understand that I need to cover politics some, and sometimes a good bit, but I'm a lot more interested in more human things, the micro that tells us something about the macro.
Yes, that's how it seems to me. Again, somebody on one of those NPR blurbs said something along the lines of politics is basically just human interaction, which it is.
Right.
So if you are writing about people, which you are all the time, well, not all the time, but you're writing about people and the place, that affords you the latitude to talk about a very specific local issue like Fort Negley, because it has resonance that goes way beyond the parameters of downtown Nashville.
And isn't it an interesting story?
Mm-hmm.
That's the other thing. Is something happening that's just interesting to know about? It's interesting to know that this is where the enslaved people fled to when, you know, during the Civil War. And equally interesting to know that what the Union soldiers promptly did was enslave them again, this time to building the fort. It's just a really interesting, unexpected thing, little tiny episode in history that we still have evidence of today.
So, as a cut line, something along the lines of, expect the unexpected when you come to the South.
Always. But don't you think that's true for everywhere?
It's a good question. So many people go to London to see Buckingham Palace and the changing of the guards and, I don't know, whatever else they go there for, and Piccadilly Circus maybe, I don't know. You have definitely experienced something, but it's not really London, it's just, I don't know, it's just a business, really. It's just, it's just tourism. But I had lunch a number of years ago with my father's brother, and his son had spent something like 3 or 4 months in Los Angeles. And he said, oh, yeah, I've been to America. And then he went off on this long disquisition about America. I said, well, first of all, you're only in Los Angeles, so what you know of America is pretty limited. And second of all, 3 or 4 months, that's not very long.
No, it isn't. Not at all.
So,
no, that's funny. Isn't it funny? It's just part of our DNA to want to draw boundaries and mm-hmm. color it in and think we know.
And that's, if people were to read your column regularly, that's exactly one hopes is what they come away with. Ooh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. That's certainly broadened my understanding of life in this unbelievably rich, fecund part of the country.
I can only hope.
Yep, we live in hope, don't we?
Some of us do. Yeah.
Thanks, Margaret. It's so much fun talking to you. And again, you know, the doors are always open here. So if we ever get past this COVID, let's talk.
Sounds great. Thank you, Richard.
My pleasure. This collection of 60 of the many more essays Margaret Renkel has written for the New York Times every week for the past 4 years is titled Graceland, At Last, Notes on Hope and Heartache from the American South. This is Scenic Roots talking writing on listener-supported public radio in Chattanooga.